Mr. Pelish arguing for Mr. Shelbrock.
Good morning. May it please this honorable court and counsel, I'm James Pelish of Rice Lake. With me is my associate, Mr. Willem Norlander. We represent Mark A. Shelbrock. The issue before the court is the measure of damages to medical expenses where the providers have discounted their fees to a subrogated insurer, in this case, Wisconsin Medical Assistance. We have called that difference a phantom fee because, first, it is never charged. By law, it cannot be charged to the recipient. And second, the plaintiff is never liable for that phantom fee. It is a fee, a bill, that is never incurred. Nor, we have said, is it a gift, because in the first place, there's nothing in the record that would show any donative intent on the part of any of the health care providers. But as we've said, you cannot make a gift of something that you do not own. And in this case, the right to forgive a fee that by law you cannot charge is something that the health care providers do not own. There is another suggestion, too, and that is, of course, that these health care providers never specifically made a gift of anything to the plaintiff, nor did the program, since the program commenced in 1965 and she was not born until 1966. This court has told us that a windfall results when bills are incurred for medical expenses and they are paid by a third party, which cannot legally collect them. And that is not an issue or a rule that we dispute. And of course, I'm talking about the collateral source rule, which allocates that, in this case, windfall to the innocent party. But in every case that this court has applied the collateral source rule, there have been medical bills that were actually incurred so that the provider was either paid or could have demanded payment.
Didn't we have a case involving a spouse gratuitously giving nurse services?
Yes, you have.
He was not incurred. He was never billed.
No, and that's that has been adopted as part of the collateral source rule. A spouse who provides nursing services to the other doesn't charge those services, and it isn't expected that the spouse would. And that's a benefit that the plaintiff receives given to him or her by the spouse.
That's gratuitous, is that the point?
That's gratuitous.
Paid or could have been paid or gratuitous.
It could have been paid, but there was no legal obligation to pay it.
Now, couldn't this whole case have been avoided by your client putting in evidence as to the reasonable value of these medical services?
Well,
and what you did is you didn't put in anything. Isn't that right?
Not correct, Chief Justice, because what we did was not argue with the fact that the physician who testified said that these bills were fair and reasonable. We don't argue with that.
So you accept this as fair and reasonable?
We accept it as one measure of what can be fair and reasonable, but what we've said is that there are several measures, including the statutory measure for medical assistance.
Well, but that you just didn't put in evidence of something else that would be fair and reasonable. I mean, there was a directed verdict for this amount because you didn't put in any evidence for any other fair and reasonable amount.
We didn't put in any conflicting testimony, and we asked the judge, the trial judge, to resolve that issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the next case, I mean, regardless of win or lose, I shouldn't say regardless, but why wouldn't, if you had to do it over again, you just put in fair evidence of fair and reasonable that's less than the plaintiff put in, the petitioner put in?
We could do that, Your Honor. But in this particular case, we elected not to because the law provided that the measure of the usual customary fee was what medical assistants paid. And we believe that that was the best evidence of the usual and customary fee. What we've said is that there are several usual and customary fees depending upon whether the person receiving services is insured, uninsured, insured by an HMO, insured by a PPO, or has his bills paid by medical assistance.
And you think that that makes a difference? The chief is asking, because there is nothing other than the expert testifying that these were the usual and customary fees, and there, it seems to me that, and we're talking about the next case, that will be the question. And was this trial strategy and you just felt that it was not necessary?
I didn't think it was necessary because I was not prepared to say to the physician who testifies that this is his usual and customary fee that he doesn't know what his usual and customary fee is. What we were instead saying is that may be your usual and customary fee in one case, but we in fact know that you billed less and accepted less as payment in full.
Counsel, didn't he also testify that it was, didn't the expert also testify that it was reasonable and necessary?
Yes.
Not just what he normally does, but that it's reasonable and necessary. Listening to this interchange, it strikes me that it's not exactly, but akin to what is proposed by civil trial counsel in their amicus brief as their alternate argument, middle ground, perhaps. And that is, look, you have reasonable, that the expert can testify it's reasonable, necessary, as was done here. That defense can say what was actually paid pursuant to contract under those circumstances was what was reasonable, inherent in the argument is inherent in the contractual provision. So give it to the jury and let the jury decide. That have I accurately explained at least how the argument advanced by civil trial counsel?
You have, Your Honor.
But you wouldn't be able to meet that adequate argument on the facts of this case because you didn't put in the evidence.
I didn't put in evidence that there were alternate charges in that area. This was Minneapolis-St. Paul.
You didn't put in any evidence that there was no testimony that the amount paid pursuant to contract was reasonable.
That's correct.
Such that it could be given as advanced by civil trial counsel to the jury as part of this is reasonable, jury, you decide.
That's correct.
Counsel, did you have a question?
Well, no, go ahead.
Why isn't this a windfall? If you prevail, why isn't this a windfall for your client? I mean, had he been driving down that road and struck a different automobile with a person who was not on Medicaid, he would have had to cough up $500,000+. Now, but by pure chance, he happened to hit a low-income person. Sounds like a windfall to me.
Your Honor, it is not a windfall because the doctors, in this case, have had their entire bill paid. Whenever this court has been faced with a circumstance it called a windfall, it involved two factors. A doctor whose bills could have been collected, and they were paid by a third party who did not have a legal right to collect them. In this case, the bills were paid by a subrogated party, Wisconsin Medical Assistance, which had every right to legally collect the bills it paid. There is no windfall in this case because there are no charges in excess of what was paid and accepted as payment in full.
But that's I think the definition here proposed on windfall is that you're getting the benefit of the fact that your client get a poor person who gets less expensive, doesn't mean less worthy, but less expensive medical care. Had you hit somebody else, the bills might have been more than $500,000, and your client would have been paid. So between two people, your client, who's the tortfeasor, and this innocent person who was hit, who should get the windfall of the fact that the government is able to pay less than fair market value?
Well,
you can argue nobody. You're arguing there is no windfall. Everybody comes out whole. The woman got the full medical care. Government is going to get back its $300,000, and everybody goes home equal. That's
yes.
Your argument. But you did.
Yes, it is, Your Honor. And the reason we've said that is because it was medical assistance which, in fact, derived the bargain. It drove the bargain. Just as when any insurer drives a bargain for any of these health care costs, it in fact benefits its insured, if I can put that in quotes, whether the insured gets the benefits in the form of lower health care premiums from a private pay insurer, or gets them for no premium at all in the form of medical assistance benefits.
Well, counsel, let's say a labor union or a large group of people get together. I guess this is somewhat of an HMO question. And bargains with the local clinic, the Rice Clinic or whatever, that for certain schedule of injuries, this is what they're going to charge. And so the person gets injured, goes there, and because he's a member of the labor union, he only has to pay $10,000 for an emergency appendix operation, whereas fellow next door who's not a member of the labor union would have to pay $15,000. Seems to me that under your arguments here, the $10,000 is all that's owed by the tortfeasor.
Presuming that the doctor's bill is paid in full and his negotiated rate is paid in full, that's correct. We're not saying that...
Well, with an HMO, then, what you're saying, I guess, is you recognize the concern of the HMO.
What I've been unable to do is distinguish between an HMO and a PPO and Wisconsin Medical Assistance. This court, in I think it was a Mertz case, said that Medicare was an insurer for these purposes. So if these...
That's not the question. Let me explain it a little bit differently. Let's say Justice Bradley has an HMO. And so that HMO will pay only for medical care within this region and won't transport her anyplace else. I have the standard policy, and I can get transported. And so they get a helicopter or a jet in and fly me over to Mayo. Now, are you saying that she's not entitled to the reasonable value of the medical services, but only entitled to what the HMO will pay for?
Absolutely not. What I've said is that if there is liability over and above what the insurer pays, if those bills are actually charged with an intention of collecting them, and if they are actually incurred then that's the value of the medical expenses, what's incurred.
What you're saying is that if she didn't take the helicopter at her own expense and just took the services in whatever community it was, that she couldn't then ask for the flight costs and the higher mail expenses, because that would have been reasonable. She can only ask for what she actually paid.
Well, she can't get something for past medical expenses that she didn't incur. She could get it if there was testimony that she needed it in the future, even if her HMO was not going to pay for it, if she was going to incur those expenses.
Counsel, in the past, I'm not sure if they're the good old days or the bad old days. Let's take about 20 years ago, 25 years ago, before chiropractic was covered by any insurance and before it became more acceptable. I remember many cases where the response of the defendant insurance company is that these expenses were not reasonable and necessary. They may have been incurred. Typically, you know, persons come in for two adjustments a week for 29 months or something like that. And the response is, they may be incurred, but that's not the test. The test is what's reasonable and necessary. So the $30,000 of chiropractic wasn't paid, wasn't given to the jury, because the argument from the defense is that the focus is on reasonable and necessary, even if it was astronomical, can't pay it. But now that it's less, you're saying, oh, it's not unreasonable, it's not, the focus should not be on what is reasonable and necessary, but rather what is incurred. It seems like you're having it both ways. I mean the argument. You may not have, you know. But the argument before was when it was higher than reasonable and necessary, when what was incurred and actually paid was higher than reasonable and necessary, you got to stay with reasonable and necessary. When it's lower than reasonable and necessary, you go with the lower rather than reasonable and necessary. It seems a real inconsistency. Can you help me with that?
I can try. What the jury instructions tell us, and I think they're the best source, because this is what the jury hears.
Well, excuse me for interrupting you so early in your response to my question, but I guess I have some concern. I think that it's the jury instruction isn't the law. You know, I mean, that's as I see the hierarchy of citation, probably court-made law rather than jury instruction law may be more reliable. Do you disagree with me on that?
No, I don't. And I can talk about the cases. And the cases, of course, discuss, for medical expenses, those expenses that are necessarily incurred for the treatment of the injury.
Oh, I thought the question is whether it's reasonable and necessary. The emphasis has always been on reasonable. I asked the question earlier, didn't the doctor testify as reasonable and necessary? Of course, because that's boilerplate language. Anyone that doesn't get that question asked and answered will go home with egg on their face. You know, that's so elementary. So that's the focus, doctor. Isn't it reasonable and necessary?
It remains the focus, too, Your Honor.
So explain then how, if it's greater than, what is incurred is greater than reasonable and necessary, the argument is reasonable and necessary. If it's less than reasonable and necessary, the argument is incurred. Reconcile that inconsistency.
Because whenever we've talked about the collateral source cases in the past, and we've looked at what was reasonable and necessary, those expenses were incurred. It was never an issue that the court had to deal with before. And what we're saying today is, why should we be responsible for expenses that were never incurred and were not donated? They just don't exist.
Would your logically, your argument then, if the chiropractic bill is $30,000, it's incurred. Everyone else says it should have been $5,000. That's reasonable and necessary. Under your argument, you're responsible for the $30,000, even though it's not reasonable.
somebody has to be responsible for, in your instance, the $30,000. They have to be billed with the intention of being collected, and I presume that that's what the chiropractor has done. That was never the case here. There was no intention of sending the plaintiff a bill for this additional $255,000. The providers collected $355,000 in full satisfaction. They didn't forgive anything. They paid what a subrogated carrier said. They were paid what a subrogated carrier said they were entitled to. That's why I've said that if you go back and dredge up this gap, this difference, you're creating a windfall because there was no bill in the first place.
How does MA get to the figure it gets to?
They have panels of physicians and panels of, I suppose, lay people who get together on a yearly basis and make those adjustments.
Particularly on this case, or generally, you know, X amount for burns, Y amount for appendix operation. I mean, what is it on that?
It would be the latter, Your Honor. They agree in advance, just as private carriers do, what is the usual and customary fee for each particular service.
And the arrangement then is that's what MA will pay, and the physicians and hospitals who accept this can't keep additional funds. Cannot.
Is that it? If the providers elect to charge medical assistance, they are agreeing that that is their usual and customary charge, what medical assistance pays.
But if the hospital could get it back from the victim here, then you say your client would be liable for it.
Yes. If the hospital had elected not to accept medical assistance benefits, it could have done one or two things under current law. It could have joined this action, or it could have started its own action against the tortfeasor.
Now, the amicus brief of the Civil Trial Council, as Justice Bradley said, took a middle position, and the Wisconsin Academy of Trial Lawyers did not like that middle position, saying that they thought that it's unfairly prejudicial to future plaintiffs. What's your position between these two?
I've tried too many cases across the state not to understand that we would be tempting too many jurors if we suggested that the party's medical bills were paid, in fact, by medical assistance. I don't think we need to make that a jury issue. It has been made jury issues in other states.
And what does the jury generally do? As best you can determine from the jury verdict materials.
You're asking for my apocryphal experience, or my...
Well, you can give it to me. Usually there are books that explain what juries do around the country.
I've never read anything on the subject. My fear is that there might be some jury prejudice. If that issue were raised.
Against your client or against the victim?
Against the victim, the one who was receiving medical assistance. I think there's enough jury prejudice against insurance companies and tortfeasors to begin with. But I think in this instance, I think Waddell may be correct that that's an issue that that might inflame a jury.
Equal passion on both sides, then.
Could I ask you, on the special verdict, question 8 about the amount of past medical expenses filled in by the court?
Yes.
Is that filled in before it went to the jury or after?
It was filled in before it went to the jury over our objection. We objected, number one, because we didn't like the court's ruling on the amount, and number two, because I've always taken the position that the amount of dollars inserted in that figure can influence a jury as well. And it shouldn't matter if, for instance, if the expenses are incurred in Rice Lake, where I live, they're going to be less than if they were incurred in Madison, and less than if they were incurred in Milwaukee. And in this case, they were incurred in Minneapolis. So I don't think that has anything to do with asking a jury to determine what a plaintiff's pain and suffering is worth.
But that was the only evidence the jury heard anyway, this $597,000.
They would hear that.
They did hear it here.
They did hear that.
And there was no contradicting evidence.
No.
What if the health care provider here had objected to the figure that MA gave them? What would have happened?
Well, they can do one of two things. They cannot submit it to MA, or they can petition under medical assistance procedures for additional payment.
And if that was denied, then what's their alternative? Either take the $300,000 or nothing.
Yes. Yes.
But then, but had they denied it, then the plaintiff would have been entitled to the full $500,000.
Yes, that then it, the charges would have been made with the intention of collecting it. Thank you. I see my time is up.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Sand, you represent Hope Ellsworth et al.
I do, Your Honor. May it please this honorable court, my distinguished colleagues, Mr. Pelish and Mr. Norlander, my name is Brian Sonda, and I do represent the plaintiff respondent, Hope Ellsworth, in this action. Today, the court is called upon, I believe, in this case, to determine whether Wisconsin will change its present system to allow collateral source payments to become, as a matter of law, the reasonable value of medical services. And although Shelbrock has argued that the plaintiff's testimony is, in effect, irrelevant, I think that that is an important place to begin this analysis. As was recognized by some of the earlier comments, the plaintiff's physician testified as to the reasonable value of the services, also testifying that he was unaware of any prior contractual arrangement between the hospital and the Wisconsin Medical Assistance System, and finally that the services were necessary as a result of this catastrophic accident. And so, therefore, the trial court, as well as the Court of Appeals, recognized that without any evidence to the contrary, that the reasonable value of medical services was established without any contradictory testimony appropriately supported by expert testimony from Mr. Shelbrock, and so the court directed, in essence, a verdict on that issue.
But it sounds to me like the reasonable value of medical services is what MA would pay.
I disagree, Your Honor.
And why?
Because the decision of what's involved in what a collateral source payment may pay, and similarly, the decision involved from a health care provider's perspective on what amounts it may accept may have nothing to do with what the reasonable value of the services are. In particular, in this case, with respect to medical assistance, I think that the government has a strong hand in determining what amounts it will pay for purposes of, for example, protecting the tax revenues. And similarly, as was noted in one of your questions to Mr. Pelish, Your Honor, what is accepted as payment in full, and I'll use that in quotes, by the health care provider is kind of a Hobson's choice. They could go after the patient themselves, but they make an intentional choice not to so that they can at least receive some amount of payment. And so the decision process in determining what will and ultimately be accepted as payment in full by these providers doesn't necessarily bear any relation to what the reasonable value of the services are. It's important, I think, Your Honors, to start with the evidence that was presented because, as Mr. Pelish mentioned, there's this theme of phantom charges, and I think the trial, the Civil Trial Council's amicus brief specifically says that there were dummy bills, that there was fantasy billing and artificially inflated charges, intentionally, in other words, an intentional overstatement of charges in this particular case. But I think it is important to note that Hope Ellsworth has never argued that what is simply billed by a healthcare provider also becomes, as a matter of law, what the reasonable value of the services is. It must be supported by expert testimony. And conversely, the tortfeasor in any given case has the ability and the opportunity to contest, if they so want, the plaintiff's expert's opinions with their own contrary expert opinions about what may be the reasonable value of the services. If that were to occur, of course, then it would become a jury question.
Doesn't that just ignore the main point of a personal injury trial, which is to make the injured person whole? Right? I mean, that's the point. We're not talking about, you know, getting into a battle about the retail value of medical services versus the discounted value of medical services, whether it's a discounted value by operation of a governmental assistance program or a discounted value that results by operation of an HMO contract or a PPO contract. The whole point of a personal injury trial is to make the injured person whole, which is why the jury instruction says that the injured person is entitled to recover the sum of money which was reasonably and necessarily incurred from the date of the accident up to the date of trial for the care and treatment of the injuries sustained by the plaintiff. So it requires an assessment of reasonable value, reasonably and necessarily, what was reasonable and necessary under the circumstances, but also what was in fact incurred. I mean, it requires both, not one or the other. And the issue is not, as has been discussed, whether the focus should be on reasonable and necessary or whether the focus should be on incurred, but it requires both, right?
There are a couple of comments that I have to your question, Your Honor. And the first is that the tort system as we have it is designed exclusively to compensate the injured, in this case, innocent victim. But I think that there's more underlying public policy reasons than just that. And that, I think, strikes at the heart of the collateral source rule, Your Honor. There's a balance between compensating the injured party on the one hand and yet also holding the wrongdoer accountable for the full value of the damages that they inflict. The opinions that have been issued by this court and the Court of Appeals indicate that this also serves as a penal effect in some instances on the tortfeasor, but it also serves to deter future misconduct of tortfeasors. So there are other underlying public policy reasons other than simply the question of whether or not the plaintiff has been made whole.
Well, and how does, you know, wading into the debate over how health care services are rendered in this country further the deterrent effect of tort law or this punitive effect that you're referring to?
Well, if the tortfeasor in this case is judged to be liable for only some lesser amount than the full value of the damage that was inflicted, then that is a windfall to the tortfeasor.
How is it a lesser amount than the full value when nothing over and above what the insurance policy in question paid was ever incurred by anybody?
Well, I disagree. I think Mr. Pelish and I have different viewpoints on what the word incurred means. I think at the time that health care services are provided to anyone, they are in fact incurred, and they're incurring an obligation, whether by express contract or quantum merit, to pay back that health care provider. It was at some point in time after that that the health care provider made the conscious decision to accept some collateral source rather than to go after that person for the full value of the services. And so that constitutes a gratuitous benefit to Hope Ellsworth County.
Wasn't that agreement actually made in advance by the healthcare provider and agreeing to participate in Medicaid?
There's no evidence in the record that there was any agreement in advance by this Minnesota healthcare provider to comply with the medical assistance laws. But even if it
were... Well, isn't that implicit?
It's implicit, perhaps, Your Honor. But even if it were, and even if it were an agreement in advance, there still is that conscious decision to say, well, if we have people from Wisconsin that don't have the ability to pay us, we'll discount our services or write off, if you want to call it that, a portion of our services, just so that we can get something.
So what if the hospital just decided to stand on principle, the healthcare provider, and said, okay, $500,000 is the reasonable value of our services, and we're not going to take a penny less? Could they have done that?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And if they had done so, would medical assistance have paid anything?
I don't think so, Your Honor.
You don't think so? You don't know?
Well, if the health care provider...
I don't understand medical assistance.
If the health care provider says, well, we know what the reasonable value is for our services, we're not going to take a penny less, and if some collateral source out there doesn't want to pay us, then we'll take our chances with the patient, because they have, in fact, incurred that obligation.
So if they had stood on that principle, and said not a penny less than $500,000, and then everything else remains the same. You go to trial and you get this. They'd have gotten their full $500,000.
I believe so, Your Honor.
Well, suppose the statute of limitations had passed, and they are out the $500,000 because they can't sue. What happens then?
I think there's two questions that the court has already addressed as it relates to statute of limitations. And the first is the Court of Appeals decision in Sams. I realize that that was subsequently overturned, but it was on different grounds. And the Court of Appeals decision in Sams says that if you have a situation where the health care provider doesn't actually go and attempt to collect that amount from the plaintiff within the appropriate statute of limitations time period, I believe 6 years for contract, nonetheless, that plaintiff is still, under the collateral source rule, entitled to bring an action for those damages as the reasonable value of the damages sustained. The different type of case, however, that this court has ruled on is when a subrogated provider actually has an interest to the extent, at least, of their subrogation amount, and then they fail to bring their claim within the statute of limitations cases. And I think this speaks directly to the Heifetz and Lambert decisions. And in those particular unique circumstances, as recognized by the Court of Appeals in this case, in that instance, the statute of limitations still continues to inure to the benefit of the tortfeasor, just as if there was no subrogated interest at all.
And what do we have here, a subrogated interest?
We have a subrogated interest, and we have an amount beyond the subrogated interest that constitutes the rest of the reasonable value for medical services.
Here's my problem. I think that the tortfeasor ought not to benefit from the fact that this person is poor and gets medical assistance. So there's a, pardon the expression, windfall to the tortfeasor. He's coming off paying less. On the other hand, there's a windfall in this case to the victim, because the victim is paying less for medical treatment too. That's the subrogation. And yet is coming out with an extra, rounding off the figures, couple of $100,000. And it seems as if that couple of $100,000 doesn't belong to either one of them. It really belongs to the taxpayers who have put in this program about medical assistance. But how do we get there? And maybe you disagree with my premise.
I don't disagree with the premise. I think that this court has issued in its earlier collateral source decisions, particularly McLaughlin and Thorson, that if faced with a situation where there might be a windfall to either party, you have to make a public policy decision about who's more appropriate to provide that benefit. And because of the penal nature of the tort system and the efforts to deter future conduct and the fact that you have one completely innocent party on one hand in this case and a tortfeasor who is a drunk driver in the other hand, that if you're, there is going to be some kind of benefit, that it should inure to the benefit of the innocent party.
Will the victim, if they get the $200,000, pay federal income tax?
I don't know the answer to that question, Your Honor. I honestly don't.
professor of tax at some law school or something.
I'm certainly no tax attorney.
Personally, judgments are not typical.
It's that time of the year, you know.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, it is. But I think that the question that you pose does go back to public policy decisions. In that sense, a plaintiff who, like for example, in Thorson, that had the government services, paid $28,000 and they were never ever charged with anything, and in that limited sense, at least from Shelbrock's point of view, never incurred anything, that decision has already been made by this court. And pursuant to the collateral source rule, this court has determined that despite the fact that they never actually had to pay anything, and in that limited sense, never were incurred, nonetheless, that was going to be allowable as an item of damages in the personal injury action.
Counsel, one of the things that bothers me about this case is the potential breadth of it, and I don't know how far it goes. Some of the arguments are narrow to the facts of medical assistance. Many of the arguments are much broader than medical assistance.
I know footnote 2 in the Court of Appeals opinion that says we don't address HMOs or obviously PPOs or a variety of other entities. And I'm what concerns me about this case is other entities, how they may be affected, and should they be affected by whatever opinion we arrive at. One other comment, and I ask you to respond. Superimposed on that concern is the fluid nature of health care right now. For instance, there are health care providers who, although previously were part of HMOs, are saying, we don't want to take your low amounts anymore. We're not signing any HMO contracts. We're going to go just with our patients and have our patients pay. But then that health care provider runs up, then there is a $30,000 bill. No one's going to pay that except if they go to a lawsuit and get it reimbursed. All of those kind of fluid ramifications of the healthcare industry concern me now, and I want to know if we can keep this kind of case specific to medical assistance or can't, or it doesn't make any sense.
Well, just to continue on that theme, are there providers out there that are now not providing care to the indigent because they know what the circumstances that they'll be faced with in terms of what they'll be provided for compensation? In terms of your underlying question about how far does this court go in utilizing this case to issue law for the state, I think it was appropriate for the Court of Appeals in this case to note in its footnote that we're going to be talking about medical assistance in this case, and perhaps, maybe, there are additional arguments that would inure to the benefit of a tortfeasor if it were an HMO. And I think, I don't purport to make his argument, but I think the argument would go, well, look, if you are involved in a group HMO, you get together and you collectively predetermine in advance what the reasonable value of your services are. And so then you're going to be stuck with that amount. If I were to go that route and you were to issue a decision that would encompass everything, I think the simpler rule remains what the rule is today, which is you can provide evidence, both sides, injured party and tortfeasor, as to what the reasonable amount of the services are. Nonetheless, you continue to have a collateral source rule that does not, for a variety of reasons, including the evidentiary reasons that Mr. Pelish admitted to, you don't utilize that in the jury context. But yet, you can have expert opinion on both sides to discuss the matter of what truly is reasonable and necessary. I do think that in the same argument that medical assistance, the payor as well as the person or the entity receiving that amount, makes decisions not necessarily based upon the reasonable value, I think that argument still does apply to HMOs. In other words, the provider is agreeing to accept an amount not necessarily based upon the reasonable value of the services, but in return for volume business. And does that really make any difference under the collateral source rule if they're agreeing for some reason to discount something, assuming that it's less than the reasonable value? Why should that inure to the benefit of the tortfeasor in a different fashion than it would in medical assistance? So I think it would be appropriate for this court to limit its decisions to the facts of this case, but if for some reason it went beyond, I think somewhat similar arguments would apply on both sides, Your Honor.
Counsel, the way Mr. Pelish states the issue is this: where a healthcare provider has contracted in advance to perform medical services, did I hear you say that there was no contract here between the healthcare provider and the state of Wisconsin?
There's no evidence of any prior contractual arrangement, and we don't know if it was something that was done after or before.
So there's nothing in the record to indicate that there was a contract?
Nothing in our record, Your Honor, no. I'm not saying that there wasn't. I honestly don't know. It wasn't introduced as evidence,
Would that make a difference?
In this case, with respect to medical assistance, I don't think it is.
Well, I was thinking that if you've got a contract, you're not being dragged kicking and screaming into taking a bird in the hand as opposed to hoping for two in the bush. Whereas without a contract, you could say that they were dragged kicking and screaming.
And maybe that would hold true if this were an HMO case, but I think that there is a decision on part of healthcare providers, whether it's in advance of treating people or after the fact, that we have to obtain something for our services that we're providing at this hospital as emergency services to individuals, we might as well just agree to take whatever the government will pay us. At least it's something. I mean, the alternative is nothing. I believe that the Court of Appeals in this case correctly relied upon Thorson and McLaughlin as the underlying source for the collateral source rule, and correctly limited Heifetz and Lamberts to situations where the subrogated party had failed to advance their interests within the statute of limitations period. It is significant to note, I think, Your Honor, that neither Heifetz or the Lambert decisions involved a situation where the subrogation amount was, in fact, less than the reasonable value of the services. To the extent that those cases have some language that the collateral source rule is inapplicable when you have a subrogated interest involved, I think the Court of Appeals in this case correctly construed this to mean that's true as it applies to the subrogated amount. In other words, in this case, the plaintiff couldn't say, well, we're going to use the collateral source rule to say that the subrogated interest gets its $300,000+, and we get $500,000+. And to the extent, in that limited sense, the collateral source rule is inapplicable. But neither of those cases speak to the question of, well, what if the subrogated amount is, in fact, less than the reasonable value of the medical services?
Isn't the focus, if you're making it on the reasonable, quote-unquote, value of the medical services, always going to be on the highest measure of that? And doesn't it depend on who's paying? I mean, if you've got a fee-for-service plan, or if you've got a private payor that's going to pay top dollar as opposed to some discounted amount pursuant to contract or statute, then, I mean, your focus is always going to be on whatever the highest value is that could be recovered by, the most expensive payer, and that will necessarily always inflate these awards beyond anything that was ever incurred by anybody.
Well, two things, Your Honor. I think that...
And is that a good idea from a policy standpoint?
It's not a good idea from a policy standpoint to simply have the reasonable value of medical services, which I think is a constant and ascertainable, Your Honor. It's the cost that seems to change depending upon the victim. In other words, does a person belong to an HMO or PPO, or they have to pay it themselves, or they're on medical assistance? And that's the rule that I don't think would be appropriate for this court to adopt.
Yeah, but your measure doesn't focus on what was medically necessary to treat these injuries, which is, I think, what the law should be focused on. And it focuses on, instead, how do we measure that? Do we measure that? Best health plan out there would pay for these services, or a private payor with all the money in the world would pay for these services, what the, a doctor could get under those circumstances versus what was actually incurred under these circumstances based on the facts of the case.
The focus ought not be on the payor. The focus should be on what the reasonable value is with the support of expert testimony, and in this case, it is our position that everything that was involved with the healthcare with the healthcare of Hope Ellsworth was necessarily provided.
But not incurred by anybody.
And incurred.
But not incurred by anybody, because nobody ever became liable for that top dollar amount.
And I think therein lies the rub. I don't believe that the word incurred should be utilized so narrowly as to believe that it also means whether or not there's ultimate responsibility for payment. And that's the collateral source rule, Your Honor, because there are many cases issued by this court where there was no obligation incurred in that narrow sense, and yet the collateral source rule says we're just going to focus on the reasonable value as supported by expert testimony. If the court has any particular questions about the assignment argument, I'd be happy to field them. There was an argument issued, I think, for the first time in a reply brief by Mr. Shelbrock about whether or not really this was an assignment of interest to medical assistance. I think that that argument has been waived. It wasn't raised at the trial court issue, it wasn't raised at the Court of Appeals issue. But I think, just to refer you directly to what I think my response would be, I'd rely on a Wisconsin Academy of Trial Lawyers amicus brief that discusses that issue.
Counsel, I'm sorry, I don't remember that issue. Just briefly describe it again.
I think that there was an argument raised by Mr. Shelbrock at the end of his reply brief that this is really an assignment situation. In other words, Hope Ellsworth, by virtue of participating in medical assistance, actually assigned her interests, whatever they may be, to the state, and therefore the subrogated amount might be the only thing that is recovered. And my only response to that is, if you look at the Wisconsin Academy of Trial Lawyers brief, they discuss in some detail the interplay between the federal statutes, Medicaid statutes, and the state statutes, and both of them have language to the effect that if there is an amount of reimbursement above and beyond what the state has paid, that something should happen to that money, and particularly the Wisconsin statute 4989 paren 5, that the state first gets paid its reimbursement, but if there's money above and beyond that, that is returned to the payor. And I think the argument of their brief, Your Honor, is that both federal and state statutes contemplate such a thing as the collateral source rule, that there may be recovery for something above and beyond simply what medical assistance chose it would pay. If it is in fact an assignment, however, and not simply an assertion of subrogation rights, then the state stands in the full shoes of Hope Ellsworth and would still be able to recover the full value of the medical services. It's just, it doesn't affect the dollar amounts, Your Honor.
Who recovers it then, the state or your client?
Well, under that theory, it would be the state, but the amount above and beyond what was reimbursed to the state would nonetheless go back to the recipient, Your Honor.
That's what I'm asking you. So the state, even under the assignment theory, your theory is that the state gets what it paid, EMA.
Yes.
And that your client, under these doctrines, is entitled under the federal law to the over amount, the excess.
Yes, Your Honor, and that would further the purpose of attempting to achieve financial independence for indigent individuals and be off the rolls, so to speak. This court should affirm the trial court and the Court of Appeals' decision on this issue. The methodology for determining how to value past medical expenses should remain as it has in the past. Both parties have the opportunity to present expert testimony on the subject of the value of the services rendered. If there is contradictory testimony, the question is one for the jury to determine, but no rule should be established such that neither the amount of the bills themselves or collateral source payments ought to be used to determine as a matter of law the value of those services. The tortfeasor must remain responsible for those full values of the damages that they occasion through their misconduct, regardless of whether a collateral source payment as a subrogated party has paid a portion but not all of those total damages. This court should affirm and continue to uphold this state's longstanding collateral source rule. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Pellis, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Chief Justice.
Well, do you agree that under the federal and state law that there's that they foresee that the indigent person may collect more than the medical assistance paid?
Yes, but it's in a different context, Chief Justice. The subrogation recovery provision, and that was what was cited, provides that after medical assistance and general welfare benefits are recovered, that the balance of the claim belongs to the plaintiff, welfare recipient. But what the statute has in mind is the fact that a plaintiff who's contributory negligent may not recover his entire judgment. Maybe he only recovers 60% of it. But the law provides that medical assistance and general relief is paid first. So it's not talking about the statute that's cited by Waddle is not referring to recovery of phantom charges. What it's talking about is that the plaintiff is entitled to his own award for pain and suffering or lost wages after payment of medical assistance. Very briefly, a comment on how medical assistance works. Once a healthcare provider submits a bill to medical assistance, it's like submitting the bill to any other healthcare provider, with a couple of exceptions. State laws enacted because of federal requirements provide that if the state, i.e., the government, is paying medical bills, what it pays is all the healthcare providers can charge. The other provision.
Was there a bill submitted here by the healthcare provider?
Yes, there's a stipulation that.
What was the amount of the bill that they submitted?
We don't know.
That's not in the record.
That's not in the record.
So it could have been $550,000, and they were told, nope, we're only going to pay $350,000.
We don't know if it was a bill or if it was a statement of services. What we know is that, according to the stipulation that the parties entered into, that the healthcare providers agreed to accept and did accept medical assistance as payment in full. And that's what the law provides, that
right,
if you bill medical assistance, you accept their payments as payment in full.
What I'm getting at, counsel, is the parallel to our laws on gratuitous donations. And I'm trying to determine in my own mind whether this was essentially a gratuitous cutting of the bill because they would rather have a bird in the hand than two in the bush, or whether there was, as you stated, at least stated in your issue, a contract that they would accept this amount. Was there a contract ever?
The contract is created when they bill medical assistance.
So, well, you say here where a healthcare provider has contracted in advance to perform medical services. Is that just a misstatement?
No, I don't think it's a misstatement.
Well, what was the contract that was signed in advance then?
The contract that was signed in advance was an acceptance by any healthcare provider, even before Hope Ellsworth became involved, that by billing medical assistance for any medical assistance recipient's medical fees, it had already agreed in advance to what medical assistance was going to pay in full.
So is there such a contract in this record?
There's a series of writings that constitute what I've said is the contract. First is the Wisconsin state law that I've cited. Second is the Wisconsin Administrative Code on Medical Assistance that I've cited at some length.
So they never actually signed a contract saying that when we perform services for Medicaid recipients, we will accept whatever dollar amount Medicaid decides we're entitled to. I mean, to me, a contract is a formal document. It's not a statute. It's not a case. It's a formal document that says we will do something in exchange for this. Is there such a document in the record?
There's not a separate document, and there is no document in the record. What's in the record is the laws pertaining to the administration of medical assistance.
Counsel, I'm again concerned about the ramifications and policy. And this is my concern. In Marathon County, for at least a decade, no dentists who are, of course, healthcare providers, in Wausau, in the greater Wausau area, for at least a decade, no dentist would take medical assistant patients. And any medical assistant patient would have to travel to a little city called Marathon, about 15 miles from Wausau, because there was a dentist who, for social conscience reasons, said, I'll take medical assistance. So in a 60,000 population center, not one dentist would take medical assistance. I hear your argument to be, in part, that a payment of medical assistance amount per se makes the amount reasonable. What are the ramifications for a dentist, healthcare, for a whole community that for a decade doesn't provide dentist work for poor kids? What's the ramification of your argument with that kind of fact situation?
The ramification is that by refusing to accept medical assistance, they're not providing health care services to that patient. The argument that plaintiff advances is that is not going to change that one whit, because if the plaintiff is allowed to recover this phantom bill, that's money that cannot go to the physician.
But doesn't that in some way go to your, I mean, if a whole community of 60,000, the dentists say medical assistance amounts are not reasonable, and we're not going to take them because we can't make as much money, doesn't that in some way attack your argument that the amount is inherently reasonable? Or am I misconstruing something? Isn't that your argument?
I'm not sure about what's going on in Marathon County.
I know.
I assume you are.
I'm concerned about, again, the ramifications of your argument. And I hear your argument to be that the amount paid by medical assistance is, by fact of payment, is inherently reasonable.
What I'm arguing, Your Honor, is that the healthcare provider who accepts medical assistance payments is saying to the world, this is a reasonable charge and I accept it. That's all. And if you do accept it as a health care provider, you can't charge anymore, and you don't charge anymore. I see my time is up.
Somebody, can you stay there for a moment?
Sure.
Somebody owes me $100 because I gave him $100 bill, and he offers me $50 in full payment. He says, I can't, there's no way I can come up with another $50. If I take $50, are you saying that I am conceding that this is a reasonable compensation for the $100 I lent him?
Absolutely not, and I'm not suggesting that you're donating $50 either, unless you express some intent to donate it. The question is not strictly a pecuniary transfer. It's a transfer of services, and the question is, what is that transfer of services worth? And what we've said is it's worth what a reasonable physician will accept for it. And when they accept under no duress a payment for medical assistance that is usual and customary by law, then we've argued that that is what's fair and reasonable in this case. And we don't see the distinction between what MA charges in advance or agrees to pay in advance is any different between what a PPO or an HMO or a private insurer agrees to pay in advance. They're the same. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pelish. That concludes our hearing on 98-0294. The court will take a few